Tarmans are on building cleaning, so if you have complaints, let me know. But it was, so I mean this in sincerity. My job is to vacuum, so I've got to complain about vacuuming, you got to come see me. But it was nice to vacuum and see, like, we got crumbs. I got little kids around. Like, I was glad to see that, you know, we have little kids here and we have to clean up after them. I was also refreshing that it wasn't my little kids. So, like, we've moved into a new stage. And I wasn't going to call out who is the dirtiest, but right around Roth and Jessica, really just the messiest place right there. So, so what did we talk about last week? Yeah, so we talked about that at some point, everyone has to answer that question. Who is Jesus? Who is Jesus to you? Who is Jesus in the world? And so what else? What did we talk about who Jesus was? Mason? Going to talk a little bit more about that today. What else? Yeah, just what we talked about. Yeah. Yep. We talked about that perspective of a lot of people in the world is that he's just a good man. He's a nice man. And we talked about how if you take that view, like, he's really not any different than Buddha. Like that's Buddha's role. He's a good man teaching good things to make people be better people. And so one of the things that we pointed to, so we went through a couple different examples, but really looked at how Jesus said that he's something that no one else says that they are. And specifically, we looked at Mark 4, and when they asked him, are you the Messiah? Are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? Jesus said, I am. He said that he is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies, and that he put himself on the same playing field as God. And then at the very end, we talked about how you really have three options with someone who does that, someone who makes these claims, someone who does these type of things that the apostles are claiming about Jesus, then that Jesus claimed about himself. If someone claims to be on the level playing field with God, they're either crazy, like they're a lunatic, like no one does that, or they're intending to deceive everyone, so they're a liar, or they're in fact telling the truth. But you don't end up with, he's just a good man. Like, a good man doesn't say things that are false. A good man isn't crazy. He has to be kind of one of these three buckets. Any other comments or from last week? Okay. So last week we really talked about the life of Jesus. Now, this week I want to focus in on the death, and I want to focus in on two elements. One, I'll call it the reality of his death, and the other is the fit of his death in this story, in the continuation. And so I feel like a huge evidence for scriptures and God is this cohesiveness of the story, and the death of Christ fits into that cohesiveness of the story. And then next week we'll talk about the resurrection. Before we continue, Oren, would you lead us in prayer?
Thank you.
So one thing that I'm going to use two different examples for both sections here, and one here is I want to think about expertise. And so both of the examples I think in our normal world make sense to us. Like they're fundamentally, we just kind of understand them because of our culture. But then when we start layering these topics into religious setting, we kind of lose sight of it because it's I don't know why. I don't have a good handle. Maybe it's just because it's religious. Sometimes we use different words. And so in both of the topics I'm gonna go through a reasonable test and just what we do today. And so I want to think about expertise. So we all have jobs and different roles in them and have been doing them different for different times. But I'm going to call out a couple people that we think about. So Dakin worked for State Farm. How long did you work for State Farm? 34 years. And was all of that in claims, CAT? And so Dakin was an expert. Like, he was a resource in catastrophe claims at State Farm. People would go to him. He would be called in to help with things. He knew how to do it. And if Dakin gave advice or recommendations, people took it. Right? So, like, we understand time and training and expertise and a role. And were there consequences if Dakin failed? So perhaps not immediate consequences of the job, but there are consequences for people in a catastrophe. Like, if he made poor decisions, people could be impacted. Scott, same way. How long have you been financial planning? So, like, you have expertise. Like, people come to Scott for expertise on financial planning. Like, he has knowledge that he can bring to people, and people come to him. He has training, he has experience, and if he doesn't do a good job, like, people's money are at stake, right? Like, those are, like, we have a foundational understanding of people have jobs and are expected to do them well and having expertise. And so let's hang on to that for a second. And I want to read John 19. And then I would like us to narrate back. And I know I have lengthier readings. I like lengthier readings. Like, I think it gives context. I think it helps us to think about and to focus. But I'm going to read John 19. And then we'll talk about the first two questions that I had on the worksheet. Actually, sorry, my notes say I should start in John 18, in starting in 28. Then they led Jesus away from Caiaphas into the praetorium. And it was early, and they themselves did not enter into the praetorium, so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Before Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not deliver him to you." So Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." And the Jews said to him, "We are not permitted to put anyone to death, to fulfill the words of Jesus which he had spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die." Therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priest delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I release someone for you at Passover. Do you wish that I release for you the king of the Jews?" So they cried out again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. Pilate then took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put him on his head, and put a purple robe on him. And they began to come up to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews," and to give him slaps in the face. Pilate came out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you so that you may know I find no guilt in him." Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." So when the chief priests and the officials saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify, crucify." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid, and he entered into the praetorium again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You do not speak to me. Do you not know I have the authority to release you, and I have authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin." As a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar." Therefore, when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the pavement, on the judgment seat at a place called the Pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the day of preparation for the Passover. It was about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." So they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So we'll pause there. We'll come back. Why was Jesus... I worded the question specifically not to... Why Jesus died, or why was Jesus killed, but why was Jesus executed? What did you have? It talks about here that the Jews say they cannot put him to death. Why? Because Pilate points them and says, "You take care of him. It's a religious problem. Take care of it." So the Jews, based on their law, wanted and felt like they were justified in executing him for what? So Oren said that Jesus put himself as God. So it was blasphemy. But they were not, because of the government in place, they were not allowed to put him to death. And so they had to go to the Roman government to make this request. And what's Pilate's response? Yeah, I mean, multiple times he says, "I find no guilt with this man." So then, why were the Jews allowed to? Why was he crucified? Yeah, they really dug deep on trying to find thing after thing to catch him up, and Pilate kept pushing back, no, 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 and it seems like the only point at which it catches him is when they pull in that he's not supportive of Caesar, and obviously Pilate doesn't want that, but it seems like that there's immense, so it calls out that the chief priest was involved in this, and so this would have been a powerful figure. Even in, let alone in the Jewish faith, but just in this community. It feels really all the way around a little sketchy, right? Like this wouldn't pass a good test today of what would constitute executing someone. It doesn't really seem, I suppose from a Jewish standpoint, it probably seems somewhat clear-cut if they believe that he's claiming things that he's not. But from a Roman standpoint, this is not a tight case that's being played out here. Any other comments on that, Mason? Yeah, so in 19 verse 7, it says, he made himself out to be the Son of God. And so in their mind, there's no question about what he's saying. And so, in their mind, he's clearly not Lord. And so, I don't know whether they would put him in the liar or lunatic bucket. But it is clear what claims he's making to them. And Dakin's word, I think it's appropriate, them feeling threatened by that. Other comments? Let's keep reading. So in 19 verse 16, so Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. They took Jesus, therefore, and he went out, bearing his cross to the place of the skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two other men, one on either side, and Jesus in between. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It was written, Jesus, the Nazarene, the King of the Jews. Therefore many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Latin, and in Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews were saying to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but that he said, I am King of the Jews. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. Then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his outer garments and made four parts, a part for every soldier, and also the tunic. Now the tunic was seamless and woven in one piece. So they said to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to decide who it shall be. This was to fulfill the scripture. They divided my outer garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. Therefore the soldiers did these things. But standing by the cross of Jesus was his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. Then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. After this, Jesus, knowing all things had been already accomplished to fulfill the scripture, said, I am thirsty. A jar full of sour wine was standing there, so they put a sponge full of sour wine upon a branch of hyssop and brought it up to his mouth. Therefore, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished, and he bowed his head. and gave up his spirit. Then the Jews, because of the day of preparation, so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man and of the other who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw him, that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. And he who had been testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he's telling the truth, so that you also may believe. For these things came to pass to fulfill the scripture, not a bone of him shall be broken. And again another scripture says, they shall look on him whom they pierced. We'll stop there. Let's talk about the crucifixion. Tell me what you wrote. Tell me what was described about the crucifixion. What do you know about the crucifixion? So he was, and that happened to Jesus, but my understanding is that's not unique to a crucifixion, that happened often before a crucifixion. What else? Yeah. And so, I mean, it fits the imagery we have, is here two thieves are being crucified, and it's interesting, like that robbery is a much tighter case than probably what's being presented before Jesus here. What else? Mike? Yeah, so this is a wide open, everyone to see, and I think that's intentional. There's a deterrent element to it. See what happens when you are a thief. See what happens when you blaspheming God. Here's what it looks like. How does so it's talked about that they break their legs. Why were they breaking legs? Yeah. Why do they need to push up? Yeah. So it gets a little bit gruesome, but I think it's helpful to think about. Actually, when I was in high school, I had to give an informative speech. I can't even remember what the proper term is, but it had to be a factual speech, and I chose crucifixion. And so I actually brought a skeleton into. Zoom just went down again. I brought a skeleton into the classroom to talk through what the crucifixion looked like. And talk through that process of someone being crucified. But, I got a slide here, but I got something blocking my way here. Hang on. Just leave it on my screen. I'm going to go into detail because I think it matters to the evidence of Christ's death. And so if you think about, so in John, he just says they crucified him. And it's just something that happened. But this crucifixion, it wasn't me and Chase getting together and pinning someone up and never had done it before. Like, these were experts. These were people that were trained. They knew exactly where to put the nails. They knew exactly how to do it. They knew exactly how someone died. They knew what to do and what the process was. This was not new to them. They were trained. And these people, if they at the end of it, that person didn't die, they weren't going to live. Like, this was their job. Their job was to kill people in this way. And they were experts at it. And they knew. So it's a common, so in scriptures it talks about pierced in the hand. An interesting thing is we tend to layer on things that we understand. We think about hand as like from your wrist up. Like that's, in biblical times, it would have included the wrist. The hand would have. And so if you pierced into the palm, it wouldn't sustain weight. And so they had to pierce down here. And so the picture up on the left is a lower piercing. And that's science. Like, we don't like to think about that type of execution and understanding that about the human body, but these people did. They knew where they needed to put the nail so that someone could sustain some life, so that there was that deterrence, that humiliation that Mike was talking about. But then they also knew exactly where to put it on the foot too. And you think, like, for a long time, I always thought that it was just bleeding out. Like, them bleeding out was the cause of their death. And that's not the case. So, it's hard to think about, but if your hands are pinned up and you're hunched over, you can't exhale. And you need to. And so what happens is people push up on their legs so that they can catch a breath and exhale. But then they're feeling the pain on their feet. And so you have this up and down, excruciating. So you're having pain on your feet to exhale, and then you go back down on your arms to alleviate the pain on your feet. Now you're feeling the pain on your arms. This is a horrible, horrible process. And if you think about, these people would have been whipped, and so they're dragging their open backs against the wood of the cross. So it's a horrible, horrible, but the men that are doing this, they know exactly what they're doing. They know the process, they know how long it takes, they know that it's suffocation that kills them. This is intentionally designed to be a deterrent, but they know what they're doing. And so, Jesus died. Like, there's questions that come up. Well, because we're going to talk about the resurrection next. And so we're laying the foundation of, they didn't take him off the cross. He didn't walk away. He didn't come down from there and the disciples hid him away. The disciples did not have control over this crucifixion. The Roman government, these soldiers, these experts had control over this crucifixion. And Jesus died. And so when they came to break their legs so that they would die more quickly, so they couldn't push up anymore, they came to Jesus and they didn't break his legs because he was already dead. He was dead. The soldiers knew he was dead. They were experts at death. And John calls out that one of the soldiers came and pierced him. When you have the trauma of a crucifixion, I looked up the medical words. I'm horrible with medical words. I'm terrible at pronouncing things, but you can look it up yourself. There's medically something that happens when you have the trauma of lots of blood loss and trouble exhaling, and it results in what's described here. When you put a spear in a certain place near the heart, it produces this mixture of blood and water. That they would have known. Like, this is, you know, we think about it as old and they didn't know things and medically and all. I don't know if they knew what it was medically, if they had some medical term for it, but they knew what that meant. These men were experts at killing. Jesus was dead. He died. What else? Other comments? Other comments that you have on crucifixion? Okay, Okay, so I'm going to shift gears. So we need to think about that we're laying the foundation for what we're about to bring next time with the resurrection. But we need to think that experts confirmed the death of Jesus. So I want to shift gears to the story, the cohesiveness of the death of Jesus. And again, I want to use an example that fundamentally we understand, but when we put it in a religious world, we struggle, I think. And so I want to think about kids and the idea that if you give an instruction to a kid and they disobey that instruction, a disconnect occurs. Like, maybe depending on the size of that disobedience, it may not immediately be readily visible, but over time, continued disobedience, you see a disconnect. It separates you from your kid. And if that continues, that disconnect just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think parents see that. Like, I know that we here see that. And so they deal with the disobedience. They don't want that disconnect. They want that relationship, and they want the obedience. So when we think about disobedience, what are some ways in which a parent might deal with disobedience? So think, don't think younger kids. Think maybe preteen, teenage kids. What are some things that you might do if a kid disobeys a parent? Yep. So there's a communication. I have a saying at home. My kids are now able to quote it. The lack of communication always leads to drama. Always does. So communicate. Talk with them. What else? Yeah. Yeah, work on the relationship. Yep. What else? Yeah, so take something away. And I put these two together, but you might make them do something. And what doing something, like a chore or something that they don't want to do, that takes away their time. And so it's all kind of this taking away something from them, that you make them give up something that they desire or want. For what purpose? Why do we do that? Mike? There's a consequence, there's a resolution to that disconnect. Like, you disobey, there's a disconnect. How do I resolve that? And I need to reconcile that relationship. And I can't do that by just letting disobedience go. I need to communicate in words and with action that you did something wrong. And now there are consequences for those actions. What if it's really bad? Does that change what that action, what you might take away, might be? Yeah, it does. And so a simple disobedience in I didn't take out the garbage versus a disobedience and someone was injured or there was risk of life involved. Like, those consequences, there are weightier consequences depending on what those are. And so parents deal with disobedience, the bigger disobediences, in different ways. And so, like, we understand this idea of asking to do something, not doing it creates a disconnect, and so needing to resolve that. And so I'm going to weave in some religious words here. So when a kid disobeys, we ask them to sacrifice something. We take something away from them. We say, we want you to sacrifice your time, or we want you to sacrifice being able to do this thing. And we ask them to offer something to reconcile that disconnect. And I think, like, just in life, like, that idea is normal. But the moment we start layering in religious terms, it seems like we're like, we don't make as strong of a connection. But it's the same idea that we're going to talk about here. And so I asked to list some Old Testament shadows of death, sacrifice, and blood. What did you have? Yep, and so that's a fantastic and relatively clean foreshadowing of that God asking a sacrifice of someone, and that sacrifice being, so in that case, it was Abraham's son, and that Abraham's willingness to do that. So the Passover really embodies all three of these, in that there's a sacrifice of a lamb. You use that lamb's blood to prevent a death from occurring. And so if you think, I'm trying to think, I have more details on this later, but I don't think I have us, or maybe, I don't think I have us turn there. So Exodus, so that example is in Exodus, and it's at the end of the plagues. So the Israelites are in Egypt, and Moses is has been asking Pharaoh to let his people go, and Pharaoh is all over the place, but ends up, no, 10 plagues occur, and here's the final result of that plague. And so it really does embody and is a foreshadowing of so much in the New Testament, both from a death and sacrifice and blood and the roles that it plays in there, but also from a lamb. So a lamb is used, the lamb's blood is used, and Jesus is called the Lamb of God. And so the connection to Passover is just massive. And so if you're not familiar with Passover, I would encourage you to read Exodus 12 is where it is, but just that context there to get more detail. What else? Mason? Yeah. I heard, and I'm always careful that I don't want to take things too far, but I heard someone use that example. If they take one of the goats out of the city in the same way that they take Jesus out of the city, as a connection. This example, and I feel like you've probably seen it. It's not perfect by any means, but I think it helps have a conversation. So at the beginning, we've been talking about the beginning. Man and God are together. But then a disconnect happens, and sin enters the world. And so man and God have been separated. Like, sin has entered, and what the Old Testament does is it gives us a shadow of what God expects. How do you reconcile this disconnect? And we see over and over again a sacrifice is needed. An offering from the person is needed, and blood is needed to wash away that sin. And so there's a disconnect that needs to be resolved, and God has given us how to resolve that disconnect in the Old Testament. And that Old Testament foreshadows Jesus, the one we've been talking about. And so the example is that Jesus comes in and bridges that gap. And so we can tear that all apart, and there's all sorts of examples. But Jesus was the ultimate sacrifice. His blood was shed to bridge that gap between, to cover our sin. And so you see this connection from the Old Testament of a sacrifice needed, blood being involved in that, and then death occurring as to resolve this disconnect. And we see that in parents raising our children to bridge that gap, but we see Jesus fulfilling a cohesive story from the Old Testament. Old Testament played this out, mapped it out for us long before Jesus came. And Jesus came and showed what the actual man was of the shadow. Any comments? And so we really talked through this, but how does the death of Messiah fit in the shadows of the death in the Old Testament narrative? And I really think the great one is the Passover. And so we already talked about there's a Passover lamb. It was a sacrifice for the people. And so using this as a shadow of Jesus, the blood of the lamb was put to cover the people in the house. And death passed over those homes. Blood had to be shed. And if you think about the sacrifice of the lamb, no bones were broken, and I think Kurt brought up that it was blemish-free. Like it was a pure animal in the way that Jesus would have brought that sinless world to the sacrifice. Okay, so key points. The first one we talked about, Jesus was executed by trained executioners. He's dead. And then Jesus' death and the way that it happened and how it played out is the man, is the what we can actually see of the shadow of the Old Testament. And so it continues to fit with this cohesive story that God laid out from the beginning. I know we're a little bit early, but we'll stop there. So next week we'll talk about the resurrection of Christ.